Hey everyone, it's me, Amy Walter. Before we start the conversation, I wanted to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the Cook Political Report. If you are interested in more of our great content, consider subscribing. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is only available to new subscribers. Welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. Few people in Washington have shaped the political media ecosystem like Chuck Todd. Now, I first met Chuck more than 25 years ago when he was the editor of what was then one of the most innovative news media disruptors of its time, known as The Hotline. The Hotline was political media's first aggregator. Using the breakthrough technology of the 1990s, the fax machine, as a way to get and distribute local media coverage of campaigns and elections. After helming that publication for years and seeing it through another disruptive era, the internet era, Chuck went over to a more traditional media institution, NBC News. But he brought his entrepreneurship with him, starting a daily MSNBC show that was modeled in many ways on the Hotline style of bringing campaigns and elections to the center of the conversation. He became a household name in 2014 when he took the role of moderator on Meet the Press. He helped expand the footprint of the show to include a daily program, a podcast, and a blog. He stepped down from that role in 2023 and recently announced he would leave NBC News. Covering Washington looks a lot different now than when he first started out, and he has had a front row seat to all of these changes. I wanted to talk to him about political journalism today, covering Trump 2.0 and his own plans for what might come up next. We recorded this conversation on Wednesday, February 12th. Hello, Chuck Todd. How the tables have turned.
I know.
I now get to interview you. This is great.
It's a, you know, I'm a terrible passenger. I'm just warning you now. I'm a terrible passenger. I might grab the wheel.
I know you're gonna have to jump in. It's all right. It's good. Also, I just want you to appreciate that I'm introducing you as former editor of The Hotline, who also happened to have a job at NBC for a little while. Okay. So blah, 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 Meet the Press, blah, blah, blah.
Right,
Hotline TV is where it all began, Chuck.
Yeah, it's because you love some John Mercurio. And
yeah.
don't we all?
Yeah.
But you would appreciate this because I think you're the same. I've had two employers since 1992.
Mm. Yeah. I've had a couple more, but it's the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of the same. I did a little bit here and there, but it is the same idea that you keep kind of coming back home. Yeah. Right? Which you do.
You do. And, you know, it's fun. You've been in the entrepreneurial space longer than I have. And it's fun to be back.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, Chuck, because I've known you now. I can't even believe I'm saying this. It has to be 25 years, right?
Yeah, probably 90. When did you start at Cook? 94, 95?
90. Well, I started at Cook in 98. So I guess.
Okay.
I mean, I knew of you, obviously, because of the Hotline. But
right.
We didn't really connect until the, like, Elizabeth Wilner.
Right. She was the house editor when
I
was always begging to be involved with the, I'd have to go down to roll calls offices, right? Where you guys, it was Cook, Stu Rothenberg, and you'd occasionally let us in and we'd all interview these candidates as
yes.
they came in.
Yes.
That's when I knew I had made it, when I actually got invited to be a part of the interview process.
Well, Chuck, you'll remember that in those days when we were literally in the basement of roll calls office, which abutted Union Station. And in order to get into the building, you could cross the train tracks, but you had to get a special pass from Amtrak. You had to pass a class to allow you to cross the train tracks.
I had no idea. That's amazing. That's a great story.
We grew up in this era where covering politics, it was almost only the quote unquote kids were doing it. It was you and a bunch of scrappy 20-somethings over at the Hotline. It was the folks at Roll Call who were up on the Hill breaking the stories of what the hell. Very scrappy. And for the young people out there who see people like Susan Glasser and Jim Vande Hei and Paul K, all those people now who are in positions of prominence,
right? Yeah,
you obviously as well. That's where they all started. And the premier folks, yes, they covered the White House, but right. Where you got your political news was from the local paper, the right. guy or woman who was the Cleveland Plain Dealer's political reporter. That was where you got your politics.
I always said this, you know, it's funny. In the 90s, I used to hesitate calling myself a journalist. I said I was an analyst. And what I meant was, is that I wasn't the one going on the campaign trail all the time at the right. time. Now, did that change when I went to NBC? Absolutely. So, you know, I've sort of, you know, I did some of that duty backwards. And it changed toward the later years of the hotline when, frankly, it was out of necessity because you realized that there was less political coverage. You know, but I used to say what we did was the crime beat of politics, meaning we learned. I still have a Rolodex. I don't use it, but I still have it.
Do you need to explain to the young people what a Rolodex is?
Okay, yeah, what a Rolodex is. So it was just where you wrote down all your contacts. And it was in this nice little file. I didn't have a circular one. I always thought those were really cool, right?
Where you just loved my circular one.
I had a one that was just flat. But it's funny. I went through it about 6 months ago. What's amazing about it is that the names haven't changed, just their positions have, right? So I had like—
Who'd you find?
Jason Miller, U.S. term limits. He was the spokesperson in like 1994, right? Like, you know, you just sort of, and there were just all sorts of folks like that. You know, there's two ways to sort of move up in Washington. I used to say, look, Capitol Hill beat is a great one, especially on the House side and covering House races first. That was my first responsibility at Hotline. That was your first responsibility at Cook. The people that run House races are tomorrow's Senate campaign managers. Yep. And in 5 years of the president on the presidential campaign trail. I mean, when I got to the national sort of beats of the White House press corps and the people I was covering, you know, I'd first met David Plouffe in 1992 on the Harkin campaign. Yep. I'd first met Robert Gibbs covering, you know, when he's spokesperson with the SEC. You know, I first met, you know, Michael Steele, who was Boehner's spokesperson, interviewed for a job at the Hotline. I tried to hire him. You know, you just sort of, you realize like it just, you know, this sort of circle and we all sort of did it that way. And operatives same way, you go work on a House race, you go do this. And, you know, look, there's nothing worse than the whole good old days conversations. And I get,
well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, is this model broken now, Chuck? Like we have to just,
well, look, I think it's broken in the moment. And I say in the moment in that, I mean, I'll tell you what, you know, I'm sort of splitting my obsessions for the next year in two places. I'm in the middle. The Chuck Toddcast is coming back in a few weeks. That's going to have a new home and I'm excited about that. But I really want to, you know, I think the biggest missing piece in the information ecosystem is locally sourced national news is what I would call it. And what do I mean by this? What we did in the 90s is that we were able to, there were these weird things. I do it this way. You know, when I got to the Hotline in 1992, if you went to the National Press Building, just about every office was a Washington bureau for some domestic news organization and some international news organizations. You walk in the National Press Building, 13 floors, top floors, the, you know, a press bar and all this stuff. And it's the National Press Club. And it was a pretty prominent place in the 90s. It was really prominent in the 70s and 80s. You know, it's been declining in its prominence. If you walk around that building today, you know, it's PR firms. There's still a few international bureaus, but it's not the same. And you know, the mistake of Web 1.0, you know, I use the example of Knight Ridder. Knight Ridder papers in 1992, 1993, places like the St. Paul Pioneer Press, Philadelphia Inquirer, Charlotte Observer, their Washington bureau had one person assigned to every paper. And so if something happened in Congress, everybody wrote, but you wrote it from a local prism. You wrote it based on what the local members of Congress vote, how did the state senators, U.S. state senators vote, and then what did it mean locally? How is this going to be spread around? Web 1.0 efficiency, right? When news executives decided, well, why do we need 30 versions of that story? We could just get by with one or two. Well, for people that are news junkies, maybe like you and I and our spouses who yes, they will go seek out that information, but not everybody does. And then so the farther away you get from covering Washington from a local perspective, it's no wonder people are not sure what the hell government does.
Right.
What's it doing for me? Right. I don't see it. Right. And the fact is, it's because you don't have anybody telling you how it's done. I mean, Jake LaTurner, he's now a former member of Congress from Kansas's second district, I think. It's Pittsburgh with no H is sort of the most prominent town. He just retired. In fact, he's going to speak to my class at US that I'm teaching at USC this semester. And he's like in his mid-30s. And I was like, you know, what are you doing? Right? Why do you, you know, he's just had a really successful run. And he sort of did it the way that we've seen many do it. He worked for, I think he was a Paul Ryan acolyte. I think he worked for Sam Brownback and sort of just moved his way up. And he just said, you know, nobody in the district knows what I'm doing when I'm in Congress. He says, we don't have anybody that covers what the congressman is doing. So here, and he sort of admitted to me, he says, look, the reason so many members of Congress decide to go on the cable shows, and essentially it's sort of proof of life to their own constituents.
Right, but they're not talking about what they're bringing back home. What they're doing is they are the mouthpiece for
right.
the party.
Correct, or they're accepting the premise of whatever the host wants to say or do.
Exactly.
They don't get to tell their, you know, but when all political coverage is national, even the local constituents, you know, suddenly don't even know what they should be judging you by. And he was telling me, you know, and you take a look at just the way the news industry, you know, the Wichita and Topeka papers, for instance, used to try to be statewide. They used to actually try to cover everything. He goes, there was no reporter covering him out of Wichita or Topeka. And the Pittsburgh paper, which was a reasonably, you know, used to do all this, is just shrunk.
Yeah.
And doesn't do it. So he could, you know, the only way he could tell his constituents what he was doing was for him to, you know, email or do these teletown halls, all these things. And, you know,
that's just not working.
It's not working. And he just didn't want to, he didn't like where that was going. That wasn't what he wanted to do. He's got younger kids and all of that. But communicating what you're doing in government is broken. Okay. And the members of Congress who actually are there to do stuff are well aware of this. It's very frustrating to them. And so, yes, I think the local part is broken. I'm just, you know, I'll die trying, you know, like, let's go. I want to invert this. I do. We have to.
So I completely agree with you. So then when you look at something that called the MSM,
mm-hmm.
okay, whatever we call the mainstream media.
I like legacy media now.
Okay. Legacy media.
I actually think that is a better description because mainstream, what is mainstream?
Okay. I think that's fair.
I would argue that Fox News, if you're going to measure that, if you just measure it by audience, they're the mainstream.
Okay, so does it matter anymore? Is there a point at which legacy media, I mean, you have been in the middle of this. You were on the forefront of streaming.
Well, it's not growing. They're not growing right now. And that was frustrating.
That's what's frustrating. It seems like Americans are not, what they want is something that is more organic and natural than what the legacy media is doing. What legacy media seems to be doing is saying, oh, everybody's going to get things on podcasts and streaming. So we're just going to take our normal model and scale it for that versus no. People want to consume news in an entirely different way that looks nothing like what you and I grew up on.
No, and I think that you have to sort of accept those changes. But I do think story selection is a real issue here. And if you just sort of see over time, I think the fairest critique of legacy media, mainstream media, however you want to look, whatever terminology you want to use, is that it can spend a lot more time on news that we're telling you is important versus focusing on stories that help people live their lives. Not reporting stories just to make people, just to agree with the people. There's a mm-hmm. difference here, right? Like it's not about, you know, it's about covering the stories that they care about. You still can inform them about what's happening in Russia, what's happening in Ukraine. And like, you know, this is important. And, you know, AID, you know, I know it's not popular. And, trust me, soft power is really important to our security in this country. And there's no doubt these are important stories. But we spend so much time telling And I really think the coverage has become school marmish in that this, no, you don't understand. This is really important. And the person says, okay, but you know, let me tell you what, you know, I'm struggling here. Why are interest rates going up this high? I'm struggling here to just see if I could save money to buy a house. You know, it's this disconnect or, you know, can you cover, you know, can you let me know why I don't have better services for my kid who needs some special needs in the schools?
Right.
You know, it's sort of, and this is, you know, I always said, you could make a case, national media always has covered the stories that we should care about versus the stories that individuals care about. But local media did the job of covering the stories that everyday people wanted, that cared about, that helped them live their lives. When local media got gutted, you know, national media still was doing what it was doing, but we didn't have our local partners giving us credibility. You know, I've always said the national media's credibility was never earned by national media. National media's credibility was given to us by local media who confirmed what we were reporting. Oh, okay. Well, they said it. Okay. One. And two, who did the job of consumer watchdog, right? Like things like that. Like national media can't really be a consumer watchdog that well because it's trying to cover the whole country. Local media has to be the consumer watchdog too. And when you've gutted the resources of local media, they're not able to do that. And so then over time, people don't feel like they've gotten anything out of media for them.
Now, there were a number of startups that tried to be these local media incubators, which didn't really go anywhere.
I've spent a lot of time with these folks over the last year. It's you know, some models, there's a lot of interesting models out there, nonprofit ones, for-profit ones. Micro targeting. I mean, you know, really granular community news versus sort of regional things. We're in a 1,000 flowers bloom approach, although I think we only have 100 flowers blooming, meaning I think we need thousands of these startups, which is sort of an effort I want to work on, is figuring out, is there a way to create a national platform to help accelerate this? Because, you know, we need this everywhere. And I, you know, I'm a believer that if you start with local sports, you start with sort of things like, you know, I'd rip off the Capital Weather Gang model and have that in every single, you know, I'd hire a meteorologist to do micro forecasting, you know, and there's nothing builds trust than that. Like why I'm convinced that the reason why people say they trust local news more than other is because they get to fact check local news every day. Right. You know, and they're like,
I mean, they were correct this week.
The tools are unbelievable now. You know?
So Chuck, here's my question, because I've been listening to you talk about local media in a lot of places and your own podcast. Mm-hmm. And let me kind of posit this, which is we do have local media in that I can get on and, you know, maybe I'm on a mom's text chain or some sort of neighborhood listservs.
The listservs, right.
The listservs. Yeah. I can really target with the podcasts I listen to and the YouTube channels. I'm able to watch and get stuff now that is so specific. It can like scratch every one of my itches. I can watch cycling year round from all these different places. And so that what media used to be, what local newspapers were, they were the only game in town. And maybe you didn't read 90% of it. But you got it for the sports, you got it for the weather, you got it for the classifieds. And then you happen to see, oh my gosh, on the front page, did you know this?
Right. The accidental.
It was mostly accidental that we got stuff. So how do you really become a platform in a world that is just disaggregating and disaggregating and disaggregating?
Well, I sort of think that should be a feature, not a bug, right? Because I think about my old cover the coverage mindset, which is like, I've thought about this. What would I be doing with the hotline today? I think the most difficult thing would be covering podcasts, but I would be absolutely trying to figure out how to do it. Covering Substack would be expensive and very, but I would be very aggressive about doing that. And the way I look at it is, I think this has been the mistake of so-called these national media brands. Take NBC. I give you this one example. During the Trump trial, one of the things in my office at NBC that we had a channel that was a four box. So you could see in one time the three cable news channels plus CNBC. So I always had it on because it was more of like, let me see, you know, the three cable news channels are not telling you what's happening in the moment. I have plenty of places that would tell me news that I, what the three cable channels tell me is what's going to be the obsessions for the day, right? What's going to be the political back and forth of the day, not necessarily what's going to be the news of the day, right? And during the Trump trial, you had CNN and MSNBC, you know, doing the, getting their emails and reading them on air and covering the trial. Fox was, this was in the middle of the Gaza, the height of the Gaza protest. Fox was literally going live to college campus by college campus, wherever there was sort of a, if they had a camera, they had a live shot, they went there. And I was thinking, going, what if I wanted an update on the war in Ukraine? What if I was looking for this? And I thought, and it goes, and I'm getting in a roundabout way to try to respond to what you said about how you have access to all this stuff. We've got to let people curate. We've got to give them the tools to curate themselves. And, you know, when I go on ESPN's app, there's 50 different sports I can go find. You were just, I mean, it's the future is now. It's what I was looking for 10 years ago and 4 years ago when my nephew was a D1 baseball player at the University of South Alabama.
You could have watched all of his games.
No, this is like, he was right at the beginning of this. And this is when I started subscribing to ESPN Plus. And I'm like watching Sunbelt baseball on ESPN Plus, right? And I was loving it. And I'm like, oh, hey, Bennett's up. Let's watch, you know? And wasn't the best streaming. I think they had one camera behind home plate. And that was really it.
It's awesome.
But I was able to keep track of it, yeah. Right? I don't understand. And I've said this to him. Why are we only offering one stream of news or maybe two streams of news? Why are we offering 15 streams of news? Why aren't we a little bit more choice and of getting people there? And look, do I think people want curation? I do. I think the older you get, you want somebody there to curate.
Yes.
And but it's a trusted curator, right? It's an earned thing.
Who do you trust now?
I trust John Ellis. I love his news items. This is a Substack. John Ellis, first cousin of Jeb Bush.
From the old days of the Bush? With the
first cousin of Jeb Bush.
2000?
Yes, that John Ellis. He's got a little thing. He and Joe Klein do a podcast together.
Fascinating.
He's let's just say that, you know, like many members of the Bush world, they're not with this world and of where the Republican Party is. And I'll just leave it at that. I don't want to speak for John, but he's got a terrific Substack that actually is a throwback to the old hotline. It's called News Items, and but he's really good at finding sort of, he's all over periodicals. He's all over these journals. He pulls stuff out of, he's a little heavier on Financial Times than you see others do and all of this stuff. And he's got a couple of sessions that I share, Scientific Breakthroughs on the Brain and Space. But the point is that, like, there are a lot of these John Ellis's out there that are quite good at this. And he is quite good at this, of figuring out how to be additive. And it obviously the people he's talking to are people that have already read the Times, the Post, and the Journal. Right. So he's almost like doing that. And again, I'm singling him out. I love the down ballot from the Daily Kos people.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's a terrific daily. That's another one. Right. That sort of thing. So I think that, as you said, there's trusted curators for specific issues. But I think this should be an asset to local news entrepreneurs, which is tap into this, you know, make your own content, but actually help curate content that already exists. In a better way. And I just think that some of this can be solved with organizing and organization, which is what the hotline was really good at in its heyday.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Chuck Todd. It might be a political odd year, but here at the Cook Political Report, we're as busy as ever. Over the last few weeks, we've rolled out our race ratings for governor, the House, and Senate. It's not too early to think about next year's midterms, and we have everything you need to know about these races. But this is only available to Cook Political Report subscribers. So don't wait. Join us. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers.
Can I go backwards just for a minute here? Mm-hmm. Or maybe the better way to say it is, let's get out of where you are today and go backwards a minute to where you were and being part of a national news platform and being a moderator of a Sunday show. Mm-hmm. Thinking now what they do in this moment, what you mm-hmm. would be doing in this moment of covering a Trump second White House,
yeah.
which, look, we are, it feels like we're kind of back where we were in 2017 of, oh my gosh, so much is happening so quickly all the time, right. all the yeah. chaos. And yet these are really substantive things that are happening. Right. And I don't know, do you feel like the press is able to work in this moment? Does it work?
It's interesting, does it work? You know, this is one of those cases where the coverage is there, but is it being seen, right? You know, there's sort of a Dickens-like mindset that I have sometimes when it comes to journalism in the 2020s, which is, it's the best of times and the worst of times, meaning there's never been more really smart analysis available, data that's never been available before. Like I have more information when you think about what you do for a living,
yeah.
right? And what I've always thought my job was at NBC, yeah. which is, I've always said, I primarily was there to answer one question. Why? Why were they doing this? Why are they doing this? Why does this person do it this way? Why is this person running? Whatever. I always said every question I was there to answer usually began with why. And essentially, I think that's what you deal with. You deal with the why more than the what, right? The what we know is ubiquitous. It really, what people want to know is, well, why? Why did the what happen, right? And when I think about the fact that I have more data at my fingertips to explain the why than ever before, you know, there is no mysteries out there. And yet the front door of media is a mess, right? It's sort of one of those things where it's like going into a house that's really cluttered, but it has a lot of potential. It's all there. And you're just like, boy, if you could just sort of envision, you know, this place without the stacks of newspapers and books on the wall and the piles of, and the smelly and the pet smell and the shag carpet, you know, yada, yada, yada. There's something here. This could be a dynamite place to live. And, you know, so national media has no curb appeal, right? It just looks terrible from the front. And I do think the major national news organizations are a bit resource starved right now, right? Like we are,
absolutely.
You know, in 2017, everybody was hiring because there was, the money was there, the eyeballs were there, the interest was there, everybody sort of met the moment. Now you're in an exact opposite, right? You have everybody is shrinking. You know, look, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and pee on your leg and tell you it's raining. It's pretty clear some of these major media companies just don't want to be in the crosshairs of this administration. So if the news divisions have to be sacrificed in some way, whether it's their reputation, ABC News, with that decision with Stephanopoulos and what they're doing with 60 Minutes CBS, or just shrinking the place like we're seeing with CNN and NBC and all of that stuff, you know, it's certainly a way to get off of Trump's radar, right? And they look, this is not illogical, right? We know that he will operate this way. Look what he did to Bezos and Amazon Web Services and that contract with the Pentagon in his first term. So to me, the major media companies who are publicly traded companies are making very rational business decisions. So I sort of like left brain, right brain this, right? You're like, well, I get it, you know, and you know, they've made a decision about how what they view their custodianship of the news divisions are and aren't. And I'll just leave it at that.
Except that I think the public, if you say, what is the curb appeal, if there's any left of national legacy media, it is that they speak truth to power and they are not to be cowed by the rich and the powerful. And that does not seem to be the case.
No. And what the problem is are the business incentives, right? When the attention yeah. economy is the primary way you fund right. journalism, that's a mistake, right? Yep. You know, I don't think nonprofit works. I think nonprofit is code for leans left to a lot of people. And I think that that, you know, I think find a revenue stream, right? I think it's in high school sports and youth sports. Like I want to, that's what I want to do. I think there is a, I also think that there's going to be a bit of a reaction to people are actually craving local and community. They just don't have it yet, right? And in fact, I've run across some local news entrepreneurs who have brought back classifieds because people do want to just advertise in their neighborhood looking for something or selling something. You know, what seemed to be great, oh, I can just put this on eBay or put this on Craigslist. No, you know, they want a dog walker from their neighborhood and they'd rather advertise that on Nextdoor than advertise that on Craigslist, right? So some of these local, there's a one local news entrepreneur who's brought back a printed edition because the print edition makes money. And you know what's in that weekly print edition now? What's in that weekly print edition are obituaries with a lot of pictures and highlights from the week in high school sports with bold-faced names, all the stuff people used to cut out and stick on the refrigerator. There's still a lot of people who would like to cut stuff out and stick it on the refrigerator, as it turns out. You know, so one of my core insights of social media is we're all a little bit narcissistic, right? Or else social media wouldn't have this many adherents to it, one. Two, we all think what's happening right around us is really important. Well, then lean into this as a local news entrepreneur. Lean into it. Don't sort of tell them it's unimportant. In fact, no, you know, celebrate it.
Is part of what you're, what I get from you, Chuck, is like, you're not saying, hey, you know what I really want to do? I want to make the coverage of Washington better. I spent my whole career in Washington. We need to do a better job of it. What you seem to be saying is we need to spend less time talking about Washington, or at least talking about it in a way that is not so self-obsessed with process and with the inside game of how the players work and what, you know, what the day-to-day movement is of big people in Washington, important people in Washington.
Look, obviously there's always a market for those folks and the market or that information, but the market for that information is inside Washington. I mean, you know, I was a believer that, you know, at Hotline, I wanted to test the premise that there wasn't, that you could do this nationally. I think Politico proved that you can't. I know that they would sit here and say, no, but we have, but you didn't. You know how Politico makes most of their revenue? With their subscription services, Politico Pro, right? Which was what? The same model that National Journal had. Everybody thinks that there's this massive base of people that will support this, and there's not. Not financially. There might be more people that are interested in reading it, you know, more than you think, but not enough to support it financially. And so we sort of delude ourselves because you can find a lot of OPM, other people's money, to pay for this type of coverage in Washington and have a very successful product. Okay.
Yes.
Punchbowl, Axios. These are highly successful. Politico. I'm not sitting here dismissing the business success, but it isn't. These are not mainstream national news organizations. They're very successful Washington, you know, covering the American government news organizations. And what I'd say is we have too many journalists in Washington and not enough everywhere else.
I 100% agree.
Right. Like that's the basic problem. I mean, I just take my home state of Florida. You know, when I was growing up, we had multiple newspapers competing to be the statewide paper of Florida, the Miami Herald, the St. Pete Times were the two big players in particular, but the Orlando Sentinel wanted to, you know, puff its chest every now and then. The Florida Times Union, Tallahassee Democrat had a very, and there is so, I think the now Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald, instead of being competitors, they share, I think, office space in Tallahassee now, right? Like, and there's, I think there's was even like co-byline stuff more and more, where they share resources.
That's a big state. That is a
giant state, the third largest state. Yeah, third largest state.
The same thing's happening in Sacramento.
Yeah.
You're going to find
right
a handful of reporters covering the state budget, which, by the way, is the largest in the union, right? I mean, this is
fourth largest government budget in the world.
And there are fewer people covering that than are right now covering the yet to be released reconciliation bill, which that's fine. It's a big amount of money, but we don't need 700 people on reconciliation and two people in Sacramento.
100%. And in fact, you know, one of the things I always like to say is actually, you know, when you look at corruption in legislatures at every level, the least corrupt legislature in America is Congress. And I know that would come as a shock to people, but frankly, you know why? Because there's a ton of reporters watching. And so rarely do these scandals go uncovered, undiscovered. And, you know, for the most part, you know, it's well, I think it's well policed. You know, whatever you think of Matt Gaetz, he's not in Congress.
Well, and his voters knew. Like they had the choice to keep him there.
The system, you know, eventually works. But there's a lot more corruption in state legislatures. And guess where there's even more corruption? City councils, county councils. Because there's just nobody there watching. And the irony is that sort of the beauty of American democracy and what the founders wanted was ground up, right? You know, my other political reform obsession, and I've been asked to do a TED talk for my friends at GW. And I've never done one. So I've decided they wanted me to pick a topic. And here's my topic. You'll love this. Why we should double the size of the U.S. House. Doubling the size of the House would solve the problem of multiple problems that people on the left and the right currently have with Congress. Number one, they're not as accountable locally. Well, if we cut these districts in half and made it one per 400,000 instead of one per 800,000, you'd have that. Second, you don't like the Electoral College. You think it's unfair. Well, if you double the size of the House, that's 99 electoral votes for California. I've done this math. I went through this. And Wyoming doesn't get an increase. And Wyoming, while right now has six times the voting power for president that California does, in this doubling the size of the House, they'd still have more voting power, but only 2.5 times. So you would ensure that the popular vote and the Electoral College are more likely to be aligned in that scenario. And then you cut back the need for gerrymandering. Just because a 400,000, it's going to happen, but it's not going to be as easy to force because 400,000 community of interest. The reason I picked 400,000 is 400,000 is the population of the 50th largest city.
What city is that?
It's Arlington, Texas. That should be its, right? That's a nice, they're a community of interest. That's about right. They should have one member of Congress worrying about them, right? Pure and simple.
So you do that instead of multi-member districts.
Look, I'd love to do that, but we've never, like, that changes, like, we have to change our system of governance in some ways. Look, I do find it ironic that whenever America helps another country set up a democracy, we never do single member. We almost always encourage multi-member because usually a fledgling democracy that we're trying to get up off the ground has a bunch of competing tribes or competing interest groups. And they're like, well, everybody's got to have a seat at the table. Let's go with multi-member district. It is amusing to me that we've never told another country, you should try this Electoral College thing.
works great.
It works great. You know, we don't export that, but look, we're not going to go there. But I think I look at it as what was founders' intent. The older I get, the more impressed I am with the founders. Of what they envisioned, every little part of the Constitution that they included, they gave us every tool for any scenario. More tools than you. It's astonishing they saw the scenarios that they saw. The only thing I question is, how did a group of men who got together in anger at the monarchy and didn't want to be ruled by one give the presidency monarchy-like power when it came to the pardon? Like, that's about the only thing that if you actually think about it, their decision to give the executive branch that kind of authority on pardons was sort of antithetical to the entire point of revolting against the British, which was taking the power from an individual person overseeing everything. Why they didn't come up with a pardon board of some sort, or, you know, I think everybody, and I remember I've asked a couple of historians about it, and one said to me, well, there was probably one that wanted a pardon. Like, that was like, there was probably somebody that, and they were like, let's get it in here so I can be the first one to get it, right?
That actually would be a good new musical for Lin-Manuel.
Part two.
Yeah, part two. Are you still sitting around thinking, I wonder what's going to happen in the Michigan Senate race? Or are you, like, where is your head now with all of this?
It's funny you say that. I can't quit campaigns.
Yeah.
In fact, if, you know, I still spend 3 hours reading in. Now, look, I'm I'm like 3 weeks into this new world. Okay. So, and I, you know, if I'm lucky enough to find the investors that I'm looking for to try this local news thing, maybe I won't be able to follow the ins and outs. But like, I'll tell you what my real obsession is this cycle is. I do think, and I know we go down this road, but I do think if we're going to see some successful, and to me, successful third party or independent candidacies are not always winning candidacies, but sort of competitive is to me is successful. And we already have Mike Duggan in Michigan. I'm obsessed with that race right now.
Yeah.
Mr. Morgan and Morgan is more serious than people realize in Florida.
For what? For governor?
For governor, running as an I. Because he thinks the Democratic brand is unelectable in Florida right now. And I think he's correct. You want a not safe for work podcast to listen to? You should hear my interview with John Morgan of about a month ago on that one. He really laid into particularly Bernie Sanders on the socialism front in Florida. Rick Caruso, who the guy who lost to the LA mayor's race, pretty likely to run for governor.
Again, probably, as an I, not as an R, as an right? I.
It, look, he's debating D or yeah. I. He ran as a D for mayor, you know, but I think I, and look, I look at a California that has had 16 straight years of Democratic governance. And you and I both know this. So that's, you know, the and governor's races, voters are more likely to fall for the idea of, hey, haven't, you know, isn't it time to sort of recalibrate here a little bit? I mean, I believe the only states that have gone long that have a streak of five or more, you know, four terms, you know, 20 years or more. I think it's Oregon and Washington and Utah and Idaho. Like, I think that might be it right now. You know, you look at all these other deep blue and deep red states and they regularly, you know, about every decade or so, elect somebody from the other party. It's almost like about every 12 years, right?
When was the last Democratic governor? Lawton Chiles was the last Democratic governor of?
Democratic governor of Florida was Chiles. He served through 98. Yeah. So, you know.
98. Okay.
So it's gone, you know, Florida's gone a long time. You know, you can get there where you, you know, that's why Massachusetts gets the occasional Republican governor. It's why Kansas, well, my goodness, Kansas, 16 of the last 24 years have actually been Democratic governors, I believe, right? Rather than, so I'm very curious because I do think you have, you know, I've both parties I've believed are too big for the coalitions that belong to them.
100%.
And so, if you can find the right eye that can grab a piece of both coalitions, right? You know, in theory, that I think you can get there in a governor's race. You can't do it in Senate races. Like, I am convinced Senate races are Jersey color races. People know they're voting for who's confirming a Supreme Court. Like the voter is very educated at that, hey, Senate races matter the most.
They may love the concept, but in reality, they go with their Jersey. Yeah.
Correct. It's why Dan Osborne was never going to win in Nebraska, right? It's why these they've come close in Kansas, you know, but the Jersey color matters. And it's why Larry Hogan never had a chance. I mean, God bless him in Maryland. But governor's races are different, right? And in the 90s, you had Lowell Weicker get elected as an independent. That's when Angus King showed up the first time in Maine.
Angus King, yep.
I think he had a guy named Wally Hickel, I believe, out of Alaska, if memory serves. Obviously, in the early aughts, Arnold was more I than R, right?
Jesse Ventura
was a big breakthrough, and they were all succeeded because the two major parties were sort of stale in that state. Like that was the case in Minnesota, or you had one party that was just deeply sort of in a mess, right? In California, it was the Enron and Gray Davis just sort of sucked the life out of them. But they work in reforming the parties. That's what I always say. A good independent candidacy, even if it fails to win, if it's competitive, can actually get the parties to sort of go, oh, we gotta be better about this. And, you know, Ross Perot, I always say, helped both parties change, right? Perot got Bill Clinton to think about the debt and Democrats to think about the debt. And there were no deficit hawks that were prominent before 1992 in the Democratic Party. And that became a real thing. There's a whole group of Democratic, even lawmakers today, that sort of grew up believing, hey, fiscal conservatism is pretty good politics. And then with Republicans, Perot got them to rethink the trade, you know, their free trade beliefs back in the early 90s. And it was a slow erosion, but he ended up reforming both parties. And so if you were to say, what is my current this year's, I am curious to see how successful Duggan is. Does Morgan do it? Does Caruso, you know, how strong is the partisan relationship right now? You know, to me, if the Democratic brand is as weak as we, or as broken as we think it is, then they're in deep trouble in California too, right? Not Republicans aren't going to win it, but somebody who's an eye who promises to be sort of culturally liberal, but maybe, you know, fiscally a little bit different, I think could find, might find some success. And then you're also could have the same burnout on MAGA, where there's this sort of the center right, the Chamber of Commerce Republican just wants some stability, right? So it I think it'll depend on the state. You know, I think that's the appeal that an independent might have in a Texas or Florida. You know, I think Texas, same thing. I wouldn't run it. I don't know if you could, a Democrat could win the governor's race, but an independent who sort of figured it out. By the way, my favorite bet you can make on the poly market is, will the U.S. House change hands before November 2026?
Where is it right now?
It's in, I think it's in the 20% range. You know, that's not zero.
Meaning that someone's going to switch parties, or that there's a special election, someone dies and special election.
We're sitting at two, you know, the Elise Stefanik seat in a general election, it's not going Democrat. In a special?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we all remember Kathy Hochul.
That's right.
That's how she got to Congress, that district-ish.
It is, you know, I think it was at the turn of the 19th to 20th century was the last time there was a Congress that literally special elections and deaths caused sort of a...
Right, well, and that's also when people died of, like, right. consumption.
But look what happened. Right? Look what happened last Congress when a guy was cleaning his gutters and he fell off, and then they were short of vote for 4 weeks. Luckily, he recovered. But the point is, life happens. 435 people, you know, the chances that one out of 435 people miss a plane for a vote or don't make it, or, you know, it's, again, life, you know, this is life on planet Earth, right? And when a friend of mine said this to me about the Trump era, he says, the thing we fail to do is our own failure of imagination. And, you know, you think about all of the different weird political developments we've gotten to witness and cover over our time. To me, I almost now expect the unexpected. Oh, yeah, House changing it. Speaker Hakeem Jeffries by spring of 26. If you told me, if I go into a coma and I wake up and you tell me that's, I'm like, yeah, you know.
Okay, I can see how that happened. Yeah, sure.
True, that there was like, right. Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it just, this is how nutty things are. And I also think that if you told me that a President Trump worked with the Democratic Congress to cut the biggest immigration deal we had ever saw, I'd be like, yeah, I could see Trump doing that too, right? Like, our failure of imagination sometimes has been the national media's biggest impediment to getting things right or wrong.
And Trump, I think, is the expert at seeing the world in a very, very, very different
way. No, and he is, you know, I do think that, you know, everything comes for everybody eventually. And I'm old enough to remember the Karl Rove permanent Republican majority that lasted all of about 6 months, right? Until I think I've always thought Terri Schiavo before, it was Terri Schiavo, then Hurricane Katrina. It was sort of the back-to-back of those that really sort of put an end to the permanent Republican majority. You know, it led to the biggest, and Democrats were so down in the dumps after 04. Boy, are they ever going to win again? Oh, they got a problem. The party's too coastal, too elite, too this, too that. And all of a sudden they had a 6-year run.
Well, between Iraq and Katrina, et cetera.
And voters have short memories.
They do.
That can be good and bad for you as a political party, depending on where you sit.
Chuck, this is, as usual, super fun. You're going to keep us up to date on what you're doing.
Well, if you go to thechucktodcast.com, that's right. Thechucktodcast.com has a webpage. If you go there, you can sign up for an email to be among the first people to know, Amy, when the Chuck Todcast is coming back. But it's coming soon.
Among the first people.
Among the first. All right. I'll text you if you'd like.
All right.
I'm like really bummed. The odd years. I prepped for New Jersey governor, Virginia governor, all the, hey, the mayor's races. I love my mayor's races, man.
We can do anytime you want. We can dig in. I'm loving New Jersey too, which usually gets the snoozer race, but this is going to be a fun New Jersey governor's race on every level.
I think that one's going to be fun, and history's going to be made in Virginia, first woman governor in either direction. All I'll say on this is, when federal workers are paying attention to state races, that's usually not a good thing.
No.
Virginia Republicans. Right. I mean, Donald Trump and Elon Musk are not doing Winston Searle's,
any
favors right now.
Yeah. 100%.
Because they don't always vote in these state elections. But when they do, watch out.
Yep. Yep. Shut down the government. And which obviously was what year was that? That was
2013.
Yeah.
It was the only time their streak was defied, right? Yep. Where the winning White House, and it was only because Republicans forced to shut down the October. I mean, literally, McAuliffe's not governor without that shutdown.
Yeah.
Ken Cuccinelli would have been governor of Virginia without.
Yeah. See, we'll bring you on to do a Todd Years.
Obviously, you can't spell Todd without odd.
There we go. Dun-dun-dun.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye, Chuck. Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You are our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, O-D-D, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman. Thank you, and we'll talk soon.